Welcome to the K-12 Breakdown with Brooks and Bronder, your daily podcast of the top education headlines from across the web. And now, here are your hosts, Mike and Susie.
Good morning. It's the K-12 Breakdown with Brooks and Bronder, where we break down the latest news in K-12 education and read it aloud so you don't have to. Welcome to today's episode, hosted by myself, Susie Brooks, and my good friend, Michael Bronder, where we will share stories that will leave you informed and energized for the day ahead. Highlighted today, you'll hear about a district in Oregon who are losing both a lot of money and a superintendent. You'll hear about that from Oregon Live. Also, some slowdowns in healthcare costs are saving school districts millions of dollars, and that's being featured on both the 74 and district administrator. In Minneapolis, they're facing cuts of 200-plus positions, and what some teachers are doing about it, that's featured on CBS News. And there's also a bill coming in Alabama that's prohibiting DEI instruction at both public schools and universities, and that's being focused on CNN. I'm sure that you have found some interesting stories on the wire today, Michael. What are you going to roll out to our listeners today?
Good morning, Susie. Yeah, there's a lot of news overnight. It's a pretty gray day in education, a lot of funding news that we'll be diving into, unfortunately, but I'm looking forward to that story on shrinking healthcare costs. So we'll get to that in a few minutes. But meanwhile, in the headlines, the Mid-Ohio Educational Service Center is going to be having a hiring fair. That will be on April 2nd, and you can go ahead and find a link to that on k12leaders.com/breakdown if you're in the Mid-Ohio area or considering moving there. Let's see, institutions are working to help streamline admissions processes for underserved students. And that's published today in the THE Journal. And education equity organization Lumina Foundation is awarding grants to 7 higher learning institutions or agencies as part of its great admissions redesign. You can read more about that on THE Journal. So elsewhere, some Pittsburgh area schools are considering elementary consolidation in the midst of some nationwide trends. This is reported in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. And while schools in the Pittsburgh region have different reasons for considering consolidation, a windfall of school closures could hit districts across the country in the coming years. Now, windfall is their word, not mine. I don't know that I would characterize this as a windfall, Susie, but there certainly are a lot of conversations happening about school closings and consolidations.
That's for sure.
And you can read about that in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. We have a link to that here on K-12 Leaders. Our friends Micah Ward and Matt Zalaznik at District Administration on their Talking Out of School podcast are going to be talking with Sean Bolson, the superintendent from Harford County Public Schools in Maryland, who is in his 11th year as a district leader. And he shares his advice on the Out of School podcast for newer leaders and on how to be an effective leader without running on empty. Again, some really interesting conversations of late. Quentin Shepard just contributed to an article that we referenced two weeks ago, about time management. And let's see, Neil Gupta was cited in that article as well. So that's good to hear superintendents supporting each other's and new leaders by sharing some advice for surviving the profession. And then let's see, another reference to a summary we did this yesterday, actually, about the bias that women are still facing in K-12 leadership. You can find a readout of that. Well, we actually did our own reporting on that yesterday off of an article of the New York Times. And Matt Zalaznik at District Administration has his take on that today. And you can go ahead and find a link to that on our website as well. Susie?
Michael, did you have an article you wanted to read through?
We can do that now, or let's see.
Yeah, go ahead.
So I'm going to take a dive, Susie, into the good news of the day, which is the slowdown in healthcare expenses is saving school districts billions. That doesn't necessarily mean that those proceeds are going into teachers' paychecks, but we'll dive into this article by the 74 and Chad Alderman. 13 years ago this month, Congress passed the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare. In theory, the ACA shouldn't have affected public school districts all that much. Most already offered health care plans that met the ACA's requirements to at least cover 10 essential benefits and a Cadillac tax on high-cost plans that had been included in the original bill was delayed and then eventually repealed. Teachers were and remain more likely than other workers to have access to health care benefits. They also are more likely than private sector professionals to receive ancillary benefits, like coverage for dental, vision, and prescription drugs, and continued benefits after retirement. But at the time ACA passed, school district health care costs were growing rapidly, according to a survey from the Bureau of Labor Statistics called the Employer Costs for Employee Compensation. The price tag for teacher health insurance benefits was rising at a rate of nearly 6% per year, in contrast with inflation, which was growing just over 2%. Observing these patterns in the broader economy, ACA champions talked about bending the cost curve and reducing the rate at which healthcare expenses would grow over time. It worked. Within public education, district healthcare costs immediately began to slow, and in the last 3 years, the relationship has flipped entirely, with teacher healthcare costs growing considerably more slowly than innovation. It's not just happening in education either. Private sector employers are seeing similar improvements as are other government-provided health programs such as Medicare and Medicaid. One explanation for the slower rates of growth for employers might be that they have simply shifted more of the costs onto the backs of employees. Within education, for example, the share of medical care premiums for a typical individual health care plan picked up by employers has fallen from 89% in 2010 to 85% in 2023. The comparable rate for family plans has also dipped from 69 to 65%. In other words, school districts are asking teachers to pick up a slightly higher share of their health care benefits. By my rough calculations, that has cut the average educator's take-home pay by a little more than $300 per year for those covered by individual plans and almost $900 a year for those using family plans. It's also possible that the plans themselves have changed and shifted more costs onto workers through higher deductibles and co-pays and other out-of-pocket expenses. That's hard to prove for teachers specifically, but per person out-of-pocket expenses nationally have risen by about $175 since 2010 in real terms. That's not nothing, but it pales in comparison to the savings on the employer side. According to the Bureau's data mentioned above, districts are saving a little over 9% of each teacher's salary thanks to the slowdown in healthcare costs post-ACA. That works out to an average savings of more than $6,000 per teacher, or roughly $25 billion nationwide. Of course, districts haven't passed all those healthcare savings on to teachers, at least partly because districts have chosen to stretch their budgets over more employees. Moreover, while districts may have seen their healthcare costs slow down, employee benefit costs overall continue to rise, thanks to a large increase on the retirement side. As I noted in a piece for Bellwether last summer, teacher pension costs are rising about 8% every year, and they have shown no signs of slowing down. In other words, district budget officials have gotten a measure of relief from the slowdown in healthcare expenses, but the average school employee may not be seeing or enjoying the benefits of these trends. So those are some really complicated numbers to manage, and anybody who's listening, who has managed healthcare for an organization, will appreciate, a lot of the pain that goes into the negotiations with your providers, with your brokers, as you talk about, whether the employee contribution is going to be 89% or 85% or 69% or 65%. So I think that Chad Alderman here does a great job giving a high-level overview of these details, but what a complicated issue, Susie.
No kidding. Yeah. And it definitely affects the teachers in the end. Too bad, not in a great way. All right, I'm going through and seeing what else we have coming out of Frankfort, Kentucky. The Kentucky Senate on Friday joined the House in passing legislation for a constitutional amendment called a game changer by one Republican supporter that would allow public dollars to fund non-public schools. So if you want to learn more about the amendment for public funds for Kentucky non-public schools that cleared General Assembly, you can check that out on the 74. It's written by McKenna Horsley. Mike and I sometimes laugh at what ends up on our news feed, and this one is about venomous blue sea slugs invading the Texas beaches. And so I just thought I'd bring it to your attention if you happen to be vacationing there, to stay away from them. They look like little Pokemon. You certainly don't want to catch them all. You take pictures, but don't pick them up. They can be very worse than jellyfish. So I'm breezing by that one. Let's see. 34 Title I schools nationwide are going to join Verizon Innovative Learning Program, which is exciting, coming out of THE Journal. And it's through a partnership between Verizon and Digital Promise. 34 Title I schools will join Verizon's 24-25 Innovative Learning Schools, ILS, program to provide technology, internet access, and professional development as part of its Citizen Verizon initiative. I know that Verizon and Digital Promise do a lot of great work, especially with inner city schools, to provide them with the tools that they need to be able to help their students. So it's nice to see another article in that regard. I'm going to go a little bit deeper on one here out of Minneapolis. We have some teachers who are speaking out after the district lays out a plan to possibly cut hundreds of jobs. I don't blame them one bit. And this one is being featured on CBS News. The Minneapolis Federation of Teachers and Education Support Professionals spoke out on Wednesday morning, along with representatives from food service, clerical workers, and school bus and truck drivers, to call attention to the slow pace of contract negotiations and how it's affecting learning conditions in schools. The union and the district have met more than a dozen times to negotiate, but still haven't come to an agreement. It comes as the district released its latest budget proposal on Tuesday. The more than 130-page outline potential cuts to more than 200 full-time positions to save millions of dollars. According to the report, roughly 40 teachers, including 15 fifth-grade music teachers, 5 math teachers, and 5 special education teachers, would be cut. Cuts to support staff like physical therapists, interpreters, and speech language clinicians would also have to be made. 35 vacant bus driver positions would be left unfilled, and 30 student support service positions, including 6 school nurses, would also have to go. 4 custodial positions and 10 IT positions would also be eliminated, among other cuts. District leaders cite declining enrollment, rising costs, and the end of COVID-19 funding for the historic $110 million budget shortfall they're facing. The teachers' union said that educators aren't buying it and calls it emotional blackmail that targets some of the district's most vulnerable students. "They have done this every year for as long as I can remember," said Katina Taylor, president and Education Support Professionals chapter of MFT. "I've been in this district for over 25 years, and I don't believe it's fair to send out letters saying that you won't have this job, and then around in September, all of a sudden they have a whole lot of job openings. They're short-staffed, and it's almost like we're in this big deficit around this time of the year doing budget tie-out. Then all of a sudden there's a budget surplus when it's time to go back to school." In the new 2-year contract, the union wants an 8.5% raise for teachers in year one and a 7.5% raise in year two. The budget recommendations still need to be presented to the full school board on March 26th. The teachers union is planning on another info picketing session that day ahead of the meeting from 4:30 to 6 p.m. at the Center for Adult Learning. A final vote on the budget is expected in June. Sounds like a lot of essential workers are facing this bad news. And they're right, it does happen often in the fall when they turn around and say, "Wait a minute, we're not going to have what we need." I don't blame them for being upset. So do you have any good news on your side, Mike?
Well, we have some good resources from the Learning Network on the New York Times again today, Susie. So the question for the word of the day in the Learning Network is rigorous, which has appeared 445 times. in the New York Times over the past year. And as with much of the learning network's content, it just gives you some good prompts to engage your class with. Let's see, the other one here is on March Madness and asking whether you're going to be watching and how you can talk about March Madness as part of your classwork. Let's see, Tech and Learning has an overview of Perplexity AI and how to use it to teach. And Perplexity is another AI engine that makes traditional search engines look archaic. It's pretty impressive, as are many of the AI programs that are being released on an hourly basis. But you can read more about that in Tech and Learning, and you can find a link here on K-12 Leaders. There are conversations in the New York Times about TikTok and its potential security risk. Lots of conversations going back and forth on that platform itself, debating whether or not it's safe, questioning the politicians who are making those decisions. Always an interesting conversation, and the New York Times breaks that down a bit. It's budget season, and how are you prepared for the fiscal cliff? Is something that Elizabeth Orme from eSchool News dives into. Lots of articles that we've been citing here on K-12 Leaders. You can find that article by Elizabeth Orme on eSchool News. And let's see why experts say it's now time to assess your district's ed tech use. That's Stephen Nunu from eSchool News. And assessing whether a district should continue using and paying for a tool is dedicated work involving back-end data collection and surveying teachers and students for their thoughts. That's an involved decision, as you well know, Susie, and Stephen Nunu is diving into some detail on that on eSchool News. And let's see, I think I will go in depth here, Susie, on a story from Alabama, where they have just swept, or they have just passed a sweeping bill that prohibits diversity, equity, and inclusion at public schools and universities. This is by Shirin Fakhri from CNN. Alabama lawmakers passed a bill Tuesday that, if signed into law, would prohibit public schools and universities from maintaining or funding DEI inclusion or DEI programs. The bill, State Bill 129, would also require public universities to designate restrooms on the basis of biological sex, which Alabama law defines as the physical condition of being male or female, as stated on the individual's original birth certificate, and not the gender that aligns with how a person identifies. It now heads to Governor Kay Ivey's desk, where it is expected to be signed into law. SB 129 comes amid a nationwide push from conservative lawmakers to limit the rights of transgender and LGBTQ individuals and ban DEI programs after the Supreme Court overturned affirmative action. The legislation would prohibit local public school boards and universities from maintaining an office or department that promotes DEI. It would also bar students, employees, and contractors from being required to attend any DEI training, orientation, or coursework that advocates or requires assent to a divisive concept. The legislation outlines eight divisive concepts, including discussions around conscious or subconscious racism and sexism, and whether meritocracy or traits such as hard work ethic are racist or sexist. If it is signed into law, the legislation would allow state agencies, including local boards of education and public universities, to discipline or terminate the employment of any employee or contractor who knowingly violates this act. However, the bill specifically notes that it does not prohibit students and staff from hosting DEI programs, provided that no state funds are used. Universities are also still allowed to engage in recruiting and outreach programs and teach topics and events in a historically accurate context. If Governor Ivey signs that bill, it would go into effect October 1st, 2024. Earlier this month, protesters rallied outside the Alabama State Capitol and urged lawmakers to oppose the bill, holding signs that read, "Democracy thrives on diversity and DEI saves lives." The ACLU of Alabama also spoke out against state lawmakers' attempt to frame DEI programs as divisive. This bill is intended to have a chilling effect on discourse regarding race, class, sexuality, and national origin, and seeks to characterize these discussions and accurate teachings, assignments, and trainings that are also supplement them as divisive. The legal advocacy group wrote in a statement on their website. Birmingham Mayor Randall Woodfin has said he would encourage Black athletes to consider attending universities outside of his state if the bill were to become a law. To the state of Alabama, why would you make it illegal for institutions of higher learning to promote diversity and inclusion among its faculty and staff? Why would you block fair representation and opportunities for all people? Woodfin wrote on X. Although I'm the biggest Bama fan, I have no problem organizing Black parents and athletes to attend other institutions outside of the state where diversity and inclusion are prioritized. So, a lot going on in Alabama when it comes to DEI. You're welcome to find a link to that article on k12leaders.com/breakdown, or you can check out the CNN.com website and read Shirin Fakhiri's article for yourself. But we would love to hear what you have to say, and you're welcome to log into K12 Leaders to share your thoughts and opinions. They're important. Susie, you are muted.
See how considerate I am? I want to make sure I don't interrupt you when you're reading. Sorry about that. And I was looking at an article that I was going to read today, but I believe I'm going to read it again instead tomorrow. But I'm going to give you a little preview today, and it's put out by Amanda Gedold out of the 74, and it's why is a grading system touted as more accurate and equitable so hard to implement? And it goes on to talk about as schools adopt standards-based grading, they face challenges in disentangling academic mastery from behavior. Traditional grading methods often fail to accurately reflect a student's knowledge. The article highlights the struggle to implement accurate and equitable grading systems, emphasizing the need for clarity and transparency in assessing student learning. So I'm going to work on that one to have a little bit of a better idea how to share it tomorrow. It's a very long article, so I know we won't have time to read the whole thing out, but I'll share more on that next on our next issue, our next broadcast issue. We also have coming out from Education, the Conversation from Daniel Douglas, lecturer in sociology, Trinity College. What are micro-credentials and are they worth having? That might be something you're hearing about in your circles, about the credentials that they can be earned online in a matter of weeks, and they may lead to higher salaries, but not always. So you might want to learn a little bit more about that. But the last story I'm going to share with you today is coming at us from Oregon Live. And it's an Oregon school district running out of money and losing a superintendent in the process. The superintendent of Silver Falls School District has resigned just 2 days after a budget official said that the district is in danger of running out of money to pay its employees by the end of June. Superintendent Scott Drew resigned Wednesday, according to a post on the school district's website. The upheaval comes as the district's finance officials have floated tapping a heretofore slightly used program that allows public agencies to borrow money against future revenues that must be repaid in short term with interest. Kim Dowd, the district's interim finance director, told school board members last week that doing so would allow Silver Falls to cover its payroll costs without having to resort to either cutting days off the school year or laying off employees, she said. Her comments were first reported by a community newspaper serving Silverton, Mount Angel, and Scotts Mills. More Oregon school districts may find themselves in a similar predicament and choose to access the short-term loan option, known as a tax anticipation note, she said, especially as federal pandemic aid funding runs out next fall. Silver Falls board members will need to choose whether or not to apply for short-term loan by mid-April. Before his resignation, Drew laid out three reasons for the $825,000 shortfall. Staff salary and benefits cost came in above projections after the district settled a contract with its teachers union last year on the eve of a strike, Drew said at the last week's school board meeting. Substitute teacher costs were also higher than forecast, he said, as more staff members filed for time off under Oregon's new paid leave program. While they are on leave, their salaries are covered by the state program, but the district is still responsible for the cost of their benefits, Doug said. Additionally, utility costs went up beyond what the district had budgeted, Drew said. But Lori Wire, the president of the Silver Falls Education Association and an English language development teacher at Silverton High School, said the shortfall was caused by money mismanagement. Though tears at the board meeting, she called through tears at the board meeting, she called it the most significant financial crisis our district has ever seen. Teachers plan to file a formal complaint against Drew over the matter, she said. Teachers and some school board members have questioned the district's spending on a program called Educational Excellence, a professional development continuing education program for teachers. Drew said his resignation was due to personal reasons, writing in a prepared statement that life has been extremely difficult for me over the past 4 years. The board appointed Dan Bush, previously the assistant superintendent, to serve as interim superintendent. The Silver Falls School District enrolls about 3,700 students. And that's the end of that story. It's kind of a sad one.
That's, like I said, a lot of great news today.
No kidding.
One other to highlight before we sign off, but it was interesting, Susie, you read the Minneapolis teachers story a moment ago, and it looks like we have a little bit of breaking news here where contracts were approved for St. Paul Public Schools educators and bus drivers. So interesting. Gosh. For two districts that are so close to each other, you have a little bit of contrasting news there, and you can find that that story on CBS News, and we'd invite you to find the link here on K-12 Leaders itself. But that wraps it up for another issue of the Breakdown, the K-12 Breakdown with Brooks and Bronder. I'm Mike Bronder, and
I'm Susie Brooks.
And it's been delightful seeing you today. Have a great day at school, everybody, and remember to check Lost and Found for your mittens.
Grandma knitted those.
We'll talk to you tomorrow.